welcome Mrs. Young here today, sitting with her son Robert. Robert was the one who prayed. Some who may be visiting don't know who participates at the front. And so we just mentioned that to you. And Herb and Grace Finnemore have Jean here. Jean is visiting with us. She's been attending another church with friends over the last while. And then Libby is here, and Paul Hooper. They work full-time with Wycliffe. And I'm sure there's others of you that are here visiting as well. We trust that God will give you a great time as you visit with family and friends. We also realize that a number of you have gone through some deep waters with close friends that have died this past week. Sometimes in the midst of the difficulties of life, we sometimes think that God is far away. And I want to share with you today that God is there when it hurts. We live in a hurting world. 9-1-1 rocked North America like we've never experienced before. And many are still recovering from that. London has experienced terrorism in recent times. Then when we go south to the Caribbean, just as Dennis goes through, we find that Emily is stronger than Dennis. It's going to be hitting Cozumel and parts of Mexico even tonight. Probably greater in terms of death than any of these kinds of things is the AIDS pandemic in Africa that we often hear so little about, and the Sub-Sahara, and the daily deaths that occur in Iraq and Darfur. The reality of tragedy for us as Torontonians and part of the GTA has come to us a little bit as well. We can remember back to the SARS outbreak and how as a city we were castigated by the world and nobody wanted to come and visit us. Some of you remember the subway derailment down by DuPont a number of years ago and the tragedy of that. Some of you, if you have good memories and long memories, remember the airplane crash near Woodbridge, Ontario, where many died. And then you hear so regularly about the future flu pandemic that's going to envelop the world. But it's usually those personal losses that we experience, losses of a loved one or somebody that we know, that affects us so clearly and so deeply. As I looked into the face of Craig and Linda Schell, who the Cowans know so well, receiving people at the funeral reception after burying their 21-year-old son, Bradley, you could see the pain in their eyes. Does God care? Is God there when we need Him? The scriptures illustrate the truth of God being there for us over and over again. I was reading in my devotions this morning in Psalm 116, a psalm where the psalmist is talking about the deliverance of God, God being there when things were really difficult in his or her life. We think of Psalm 23 that's often read at a funeral, where God is shared with us as the great shepherd who's there for us, who walks through that valley experience with us and cares for us with his rod and his staff. Just over a year ago, the Passion of the Christ was released in different parts of the world. And we saw in a visual and graphic way the love that God the Father had for us in sparing not his son Jesus and dying on a cross for us. The word stress is a word that we use all the time in our present world. Our lawns and our gardens were stressed until yesterday. The rain that came in different parts of the city might have been helpful to us, but they're still under stress from droughts. Our hydro systems this past week are stressed to the breaking point, trying to provide the energy that we need to keep the air conditioners going. We sang one of the hymns, and it said that when the day is half done, our energy is gone, and we need to depend on God. And sometimes in this past week, with the humidity and the heat, halfway through the day, we say, I don't have any energy left to do what needs to be done. Between our work environments and our hectic lifestyles, many of us know something of what it means to experience stress. Elijah had many stressors in his life. And I'd encourage you to turn to 1 Kings 17 with me and follow along as we look at this passage that Robert read for us. Elijah lived in a day when the worship of God was not very strong. Israel was a divided camp. There was Judah on one side, and the other 10, and Judah and Benjamin, and the other 10 tribes were called Israel at the time, the northern tribes. The northern tribes were led by King Ahab, who had a wife by the name of Jezebel, who was the daughter of the king of Sidon and Tyre. She came from a family of Baal worshippers. She didn't understand who the God of Israel was. Elijah came into a period of time that was dark in the life of the nation. He had the stress factor of having to go before the court and talk to King Ahab and give him a message from God that Ahab wasn't interested in hearing. He told Ahab that he was going to be facing drought, potential famine, because God was going to stop the rains in the country. Then we had the stress for Elijah of needing to go into God's witness protection plan. There was a movie, I think, on TV this past week about this lady that had to go into the witness protection plan, and she moved to Minneapolis, and all the difficulties of isolation, not being able to call your family, not being able to do the kinds of things you did in the past. And Elijah experienced some of that. Going into isolation, not being able to see any other people. Dependency totally on God. Provision of food from ravens, who I believe usually eat dead meat. Elijah was there at the brook Cherith, on the other side of the Jordan, for a long period of time, until the brook dried up. How many of you have ever been thirsty? Probably some of you have actually been thirsty this past week. If you weren't close to water and you were outside for any length of time, you became very thirsty. Just imagine, the brook dries up, there's no other source of water. I would assume that Elijah was very thirsty, and he had no idea what the next step was until God said to him, I want you to go to Zarephath. Now, the stress of going to Zarephath was it was 100 miles away from where he presently was. And it was right through enemy territory. It was right where Ahab was looking for him and had been looking for him, possibly for a year or two. And now we come to this part of the passage of Scripture, and we have the death of the widow's son, who he had grown so fond of. Bill Gothard once described pressures as continuing opportunities for others to observe my true character. Isn't that an interesting description? So when you have pressures or stressors in your life, think of it as continuing opportunities for other people to observe my true character. And sometimes that true character isn't always the way we'd like it to be. Because in the stressors of life, we sometimes react. And I want you to look at the reactions of different people in the story. Many people take formal training in how to react correctly under pressure. I remember we were on a family vacation in 1993, and we were actually heading to the merger conference in 1993 that was held in Calgary. And we were excited by that because two denominations were coming together and we were electing a new president. And his name was David Krause. But on our way there, we did a detour, and we were in Colorado Springs, which happens to be exactly where Brian and Marg are going to be tomorrow, because they want to go to the big Focus on the Family headquarters that's there in Colorado Springs. But while we were there, we went to the U.S. Air Force Academy, and that's where they train the leaders of the Air Force for the U.S. There were 2,000 students there. And they would be trained to handle pressure and to make good decisions under the stress of combat. It was a 4-year course that they took, undergrad course, and many of the men, of course, would go on to flight school or to master's degrees or other training in terms of a military. Elijah had a 42-month course between the prophetic words of chapter 17, verse 1, where he says, "As the Lord, the God of Israel, lives, whom I serve, there will be neither dew nor rain in the next few years, except at my word," to the time in chapter 19 where we see him at Mount Carmel before 850 priests and priestesses of Baal, having a confrontation as to who is the true and the living God, and finding the fire of God coming down and burning up the sacrifice that Elijah had prepared, and the altar, and the water that was dug, and in the ditch, everything around it, even the dirt. What kinds of things would Elijah learn over these 42 months? He had to learn about dependence on God for daily provision. He had to learn to wait on God for directions. He needed to trust God for safety on the 100-mile journey from Kerith to Zarephath. Zarephath happened to be right near where Jezebel's dad was the king. Right in the middle of enemy territory. He needed to trust God to be able to find the right widow, because all God said is there's going to be a widow in Zarephath that's going to feed you. He didn't know how many widows were in Zarephath. He needed to trust God for the daily provision of that widow and her son and himself. I want us to look at three things, and the first I want to look at is the reaction of the widow. So we find Elijah here in verse 11, calling to her and asking her for a little water in a jar. It's kind of interesting. I believe that we have lots of illustrations of people asking women for drinks at wells. And if you go back into the Old Testament, I think it was Abraham's servant that did that. We find that Jesus did that in John chapter 4, and we have Elijah doing that here. And by doing that, he is testing this woman to see if this is the one that God is going to be using to provide for him. So he asks for the water, and she's gracious to go and get a jar of water for him. But while she was turning to go, he said, "And could you bring a little bit of bread also?" I would imagine after traveling 100 miles, I would think Elijah could have been hungry. Now, Elijah did experience hunger at other times as well, a little later on. in his life, so he understood what it was sometimes not to eat or drink on a given day. But he was asking for bread, and with that he was testing her again to find out whether or not she would be the one that could provide. Only to find out that God had brought him into a situation where this widow had nothing left except to gather some sticks, make a fire, prepare the last of what she had for her son and herself, and then plan that she would die because she had no more to feed her son with. We find in the text that after she shares that with Elijah, that he asks her to first make a small cake for him. And on first appearance, we would say, how selfish of Elijah to say, you bake me a cake first and then use the rest, when he already had just heard that this lady had so little. But you see, he continued to go on after he said that. For this is what the Lord, the God of Israel, says. The jar of flour will not be used up, and the jug of oil will not run dry until the day the Lord gives rain on the land. It was again Elijah, in a sense, calling this pagan foreigner, this idol worshiper, to start to understand that the God of Israel is different. He's one that can be trusted. He calls her to trust in the provision of a God that she knew very little about. Now, at this time in history, Baal worship was dominant in Phoenicia and also in Israel. It was believed that Baal held the key to fertility and prosperity. And to entice Baal to bless the land, each mother was required to bring her firstborn child to the high priest in the springtime. The priest of Baal would take the child, would walk that child up to the big stone image of Baal, would put that child into the arms of Baal, and the child would roll down the arms of Baal into the fire. This widow had lost her husband. She had only one son. I don't know whether she had had another son burnt in the fire, or whether this was her own son and she was trying to protect this son from being given to Baal. The scriptures don't say too much about it. God's chosen people, the nation of Israel, had begun to follow this abominable practice of giving their firstborn child into the fires of Baal. When God had very specifically said in the Old Testament, in the Pentateuch, that the firstborn son of every Jewish family belonged to God, because God had passed over with the angel of death in Egypt, and that child would be brought to God and redeemed back for a certain amount of money. God did not want to kill the child. God loves children. God wanted to show to them that the firstborn child was very special, needed to be dedicated to him. Notice the reaction of the widow when her son dies. There's anger, there's anguish, there's blame, there's shock. That miraculous supernatural provision of daily food until the rain comes, the widow believed was part of a promise that was made not only to her, but to her son as well. And now her son is dead. What do you have against me, man of God? Did you come to remind me of my sin and kill my son? Godly living and character when observed, often leads to inward reflection and awareness of personal sin in one's life. Some of you probably wonder sometimes why you're not invited to certain kinds of events. Some of you are the conscience of God in the lives of other people. And when they want to do things that are contrary to God, they seldom want to invite Christians along to see what they're doing. Often in the immediacy of death, our spiritual struggle and our anger at God and others wells up from within us. And so this widow is expressing the anguish of her heart and the pain of losing her only son. When widows lost their husbands to death, it almost certainly meant poverty. And the only future provision this widow could see is that her son would look after her as she got older. But I want you to notice that in the midst of her reaction, she who lived in a foreign country outside of Israel was still able to be reached out to by God. God didn't restrict his love to just one nation. And so we have this wonderful demonstration here of that. Secondly, we want to look briefly at the response of Elijah. How do you respond to accusations leveled against you that you know are untrue? How many of you have ever had somebody say something about you that was untrue? Only one person. Oh yeah, I'm sure almost all of us have at some point. And often those accusations hurt us very deeply. Sometimes we deny the accusations with much energy. Sometimes we use heats and the decibel level rises. Sometimes the decibel level is so high that some of us who have hearing aids would need to turn them down. Notice what Elijah did. He didn't defend himself. He didn't rebuke or correct her for saying things that she shouldn't say. He didn't say those harsh words are untrue. Take them back. Gently and quietly, he said, "Give me your son." I'm sure that Elijah, when he went to hide in Zarephath, under God's special protection plan, and not having had much relationship with people while he was at Cherith, possibly grew very fond of this little boy. Elijah couldn't do a lot of walking around in the village. He was still public enemy number one. So he was probably housebound. Probably spent a lot of time with this widow and this son. Can you imagine what a modern day faith healer might do with a story like this? Elijah takes a son who has died. And instead of calling the Sky Dome and renting it, instead of calling the networks, instead of taking pictures of it all and putting it on the web, to have this great resurrection service. Well, normally I'm kidding, you know, because not even faith healers do this because they don't want to get into raising the dead. That's pretty tough stuff. The only audience that Elijah wanted was God himself. He didn't even include the mother in the experience. Some may feel as you look at Elijah's prayer to God, you might feel the need to censor Elijah. But Elijah's relationship with God was intimate and intense and emotional and personal. And if you read through the life of Elijah, he has a number of very powerful experiences of talking with God. And he tells God exactly how he feels. And the interesting thing is that God is big enough to be able to handle how we feel. I'm sure the prayer that we have recorded here in chapter 17 is just the kernel of the prayer that he prayed in the concluding part of the prayer of his talk with God. Back in that conference in 1993, that merger conference in Calgary, the theme was celebrate his presence, his power, and his plan. The keynote speaker challenged us about risk-taking. And he made this statement. He said, power comes when something is at stake. Power comes when something is at stake. What was at stake here? Well, the promise of verse 14 that God had made. The widow believed that that promise not only extended to her, but also to her son. It seems that that's what the text says. We have the whole aspect of the credibility of Elijah and his ministry. For the widow, it's her future as well, without a son and without anyone to provide for her. Notice in the midst of this story the graciousness of God. I look at Elijah and I say, what faith? Resurrection from the dead had never happened in all of history. Yes, God could stop the dew and the rain. He could provide ravens as waiters. But bring life back from the dead? Like the disciples of Jesus, I cry out and say, Lord, increase my faith to believe that you can do something like that. What faith we find in Elijah. I look at Elijah and I say, what persistence in prayer. In verse 21, then he stretched himself out on the boy three times and cried to the Lord, O Lord, my God, let this boy's life return to him. So often we stop at the first time or the second time. But Elijah was persistent in his praying and his talking to God that God would give life to this child. Lord, help me to be more persistent in prayer. I look at God and I say, what grace, extending to a pagan, idol-worshipping widow the resurrection of her son. Why would God choose to raise from the dead, for the first time in all of history that we have recorded, somebody who was not from the nation of Israel? Probably because as we read through the Old Testament, we find that God had a plan for the nations, not just for one nation. And here he illustrates it so visually to us that he's willing to reach out to people from other nations. I look at God and I say, what love, choosing to give life to a little non-Jewish boy. I look at God and I say, how different he is than Baal. He doesn't require babies for sacrifice. Many of the resurrections from the dead that we have recorded in Scripture were of children. Isn't that interesting? God is interested in being there for those who are the most vulnerable in our society. I look at God and I say, how powerful. He's worthy to be loved and adored and praised and served. Thank you for being my God and my Lord. I look at the widow and I say, what a proclamation of faith. Verse 24, then the woman said to Elijah, now I know that you are a man of God and that the word of the Lord from your mouth is the truth. How has or how does God reveal himself to you? For some of you, you could give testimony this morning that God has intervened in a miraculous way in your life to convince you of His love. It could have been through circumstances that you saw that took place in your life that just couldn't possibly just be chance. You may have seen the power of God in bringing healing into your life when the doctors had given up on you. You could have seen it from the protection that God provided in an experience that could have led to your death, be it car accidents or other experiences that you may have had. Often after a crisis in life, it leads to us looking at ourselves and this consciousness of sin comes and we look and we say, God, I'm not worthy of your love and your response to me. I need you to be my Savior and to forgive me. Possibly, God brings into the lives of many people crisis experiences so that they can get to that point in their life where they can say, now I know. Now I know. And we have this wonderful proclamation of faith from this widow lady. I look at you and I say, what potential to be continually used by God. To think of ways and allow God to use you in ways that you have not even thought of yet. I wonder when I look at the prayer in Ephesians chapter 3, verse 20 and 25, I wonder if Elijah ever even imagined in his mind when he took a trip to Zarephath that there would be his involvement in raising somebody from the dead. I don't think that even crossed his mind. God is able to do immeasurably more than all we ask or think according to His power that is at work within us. God has so much more that He wants to do and accomplish in Markham and in this church and through us. And He's there to care and to share in the hurts and the crises of life. The hymn writer captures it in the hymn, God will take care of you, that John is going to come and lead us in at this time.